Good morning, all. The meeting will come to order. I am pleased this morning that we have two folks with us who are going to help us learn the science of wetlands and what's happening out there with regard to their quantity and their quality. We're going to start with Dr. Susan Gladowich, who's a professor at the University of Minnesota. And I have asked her if it would be okay that during the course of her presentation, you could interrupt and ask questions, always coming through the chair. But let's do that, because I don't want any questions to go unanswered. And we do want to be able to ask questions, so I want you all to be able to do that, too. So with that, would you give your name for the record?
Sure. Susan Gladowich, University of Minnesota.
Thank you. And if you'd start.
Okay. Thanks, Madam Chair. It's a pleasure to be here today. I've been a faculty member at the university since 1993, so coming shortly after the passage of the Minnesota's Wetland Conservation Act. And what I opted to do this morning was basically give you what I think is a little bit of a kind of a state of my understanding, at least, of where we're at with wetland restoration over the past 10 years, and take a look at the improvements we've made statewide in a very general way, some of the trends that I see, and certainly some of the challenges that I think are indicated by our research as well as my interactions with state agencies. So I'm going to give you what I think is a general sense of how I see trends in the last 10 years. And certainly we all appreciate that Minnesota wetlands are diverse, abundant in some parts of the state, have largely disappeared in other parts of the state, and I think there's widespread agreement or at least appreciation at this point of the wide variety of functions they do perform for society, including providing wildlife habitat, improving water quality, and diminishing stormwater flows. And so because of those benefits, as well as just their intrinsic place in Minnesota's landscape, it's an interesting thing to try to keep track of what kind of a job we can do when we attempt to restore wetlands. And as all of you know, we're in the business of restoring wetlands nationwide, oftentimes because it seems difficult or appears difficult to avoid wetland conversion during development, or in other cases, wetland restoration is motivated by trying to make up for historic losses, and so voluntary or administrative restoration. So let me tell you what I see are what I think have been positive trends over the last 10 years as the state has become more involved and invested in wetland restoration. Certainly, I think one of the most interesting changes, and these are all positive trends in for my way of thinking here, back in the early 90s, pretty much the only kind of wetland restoration that was attempted in the state was a simple kind of pond. You know, you put a dike at the end of an outlet and you fill it with water, and basically you have, you know, kind of a marsh. Yet we knew that there were many more kinds of wetlands in the state that required attention, floodplain, forests, bogs, sedge meadows, you know, whole diversity of wetlands that are important. And it's interesting to see over time that basically many other kinds of wetlands now are being attempted to be restored by state agencies. And this is an example. These sort of small pictures that you see here are what I think is a particularly intriguing wetland restoration at William O'Brien State Park that's being done with state parks in conjunction with Department of Transportation and the Board of Water Soil Resources. And what they're doing here is returning sort of an entire small stream network with the intervening wetlands that eventually will be kind of an alder thicket swamp. Also, many attempts are going on statewide to restore sedge meadows, even a few fens, and certainly some bogs. And while most of these are still considered experimental, it's still, I think, very encouraging that people have moved beyond the simple sort of one kind of wetland will do it, and really trying to sort of expand what we're able to do in the state of Minnesota. So these are attempts, but I think they're very interesting attempts. And I should say here that a key aspect of the handout that you have is that greater diversity of restorations are being attempted by state and local agencies. And I would say that this has been less true of federal agencies, and I think the state can be, I think, justifiably proud by some of the agency's work, especially Department of Transportation, Board of Soil and Water Resources, and DNR, in terms of their leadership on trying to restore a greater diversity of wetlands. I think they're far ahead of what the feds are doing. The second trend that I see that I think is a very good positive...
Excuse me for just a minute.
Yeah.
Representative Hockey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I ask you a quick question? Does this take into account, or are there any substantial private efforts from either nonprofit groups or individuals or for-profit companies that are doing the same kind of things?
Yes, Madam Chair, there are. In fact, well, let's see, there's a couple of different sort of ways that that's happening. A good example, for instance, is the Glacial Ridge Project up near Crookston, which is a private project being led by the Nature Conservancy. Also, there are, I'd say, increasing talent in the environmental consulting firms, especially in the Twin Cities, and a number of them do some very interesting work on things like shoreline restoration, also some of our more ephemeral sort of meadow types of wetlands. And so I'd say the sort of the skill and ability level in the consulting firms as well as in some of our conservation organizations is certainly has improved significantly over the last 10 years. Okay, the second trend that I see is that compared to 10 years ago, there's a lot more sort of serious interest in invasive species management. In other words, aggressive species that are in our landscape or move into a site that really must be managed prior to restoration, and if they aren't managed appropriately, will really doom the restoration. And we have a couple of species. Perhaps the most common problem in Minnesota would be reed canary grass. And 10 years ago, it was really rare to have anybody try to actually control that species prior to the restoration. And the reason it's so important to try to do that eradication before restoration is as soon as you add water to a wetland, then it becomes much more difficult. You have to use more expensive chemicals, and certainly you don't have the ability of being able to use mechanized equipment. And so the idea that you actually have a phase of site preparation that you might actually have to take a year or two beforehand and get the stage set for a successful restoration has now really become the norm, and I think that's pretty remarkable, considering time is money. And so, if you're going to sort of delay what is actually called the restoration, that's a major shift. And I think the understanding of the people in this arena, consulting firms, agencies, regulators, and so forth. I would say that again, the leadership on trying to push for sort of sound site preparation has really come from state agencies, and I would say in particular the Department of Transportation, together with the Board of Soil and Water Resources staff in those agencies, have been, I think, particularly effective at really sort of educating the partners that they're working with, and I think pushing this along to the point where they've been really helpful and demonstrating the benefits of not going forward with the hydrologic restoration unless the invasive species have been taken care of. So I think that's a very positive trend. A third trend, I would say, is that there's a much greater interest than there was a decade ago in evaluating projects that are on the ground and learning from them to improve practice. If I take myself back, 10 or 15 years, there was almost an assumption that, if we're doing it, it must be fine. And it was almost ignorance is bliss kind of hopefulness. And maybe that's what it really was a hopefulness. We really wanted restoration to work. And so if people were doing projects, then there was, little interest in sort of learning from successes and learning from failures. And failures are the hardest thing to learn from. Out in the real world, once you've done a restoration, to look at it and say, well, we have to do something different and better next time. And I'd say that the situation right now is quite a bit different in many circles. And a nice example of this is the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Lakeshore Restoration Program. This is projects that are partnered with the state of Minnesota. This is run through Fisheries, and John Hebert is the person that's running this program now. And they wanted to take a look at basically how the projects have gone, what's gone well, what hasn't gone well, how can we improve lakeshore restoration in that particular program that's funded by the legislature. And so we're working cooperatively with Minnesota DNR in evaluating the outcomes of those early lakeshore restoration projects. And as you can see here, the project on the left didn't fare so well. That's probably their worst failure. Most of them, thankfully, don't look like that. And on the right, you see something that's pretty successful. What we've learned from that evaluation, as an example, is that most of the sort of part of the restoration above the waterline is actually working pretty well. But what we're seeing is a high rate of failure of our revegetation efforts down in the water, below the ordinary high water line. And so what that triggered is a sort of a second set of experiments, really targeted studies, to try to figure out how we can improve the practices that we're using below the high water line, because as it turns out, that's the most critical part of this restoration from a fisheries perspective. And so how can we do a better job sort of in the water with these restorations? And that also extends to restorations that are being done for such meadows, marshes, and so forth. And so there's more interest and, I think, a healthier partnership between regulatory agencies and some of the sort of research community. The fourth trend that I see that's, I think, very promising is that water quality objectives are right now less reliant on sort of large wetlands at the bottom of the watershed. And within the last 10 years, interest in actually taking a full watershed approach and actually trying to build in some water quality improvement higher in the landscape is, I think, an important and positive trend, and it's particularly evident in the Twin Cities. And what I'm talking about here is rainwater gardens. Rainwater gardens really began the LCMR back in 95 funded some demonstration sites. There was, I think, one rainwater garden installed prior to that. But 95 to 97 biennium, that LCMR funding cycle supported demonstration sites that were installed in Maplewood. And that was done in cooperation with Ramsey Washington Metro Watershed District. And those rainwater gardens, some of them have done well and have stood the test of time. Others, not so much. But what they were was a really critical demonstration for how to install rainwater gardens and then also how to manage city streets when you have rainwater gardens along the sides of the road. Now,
excuse me, give us a kind of a definition of rainwater garden and what it is supposed to accomplish.
Yeah.
This is a new word for me.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to do that. So basically the issue is that we, prior to, well, let's say, in a fully urbanized landscape, the water hits the pavement and then runs rapidly to a stormwater sewer and from there discharges into a lake or a river, complete with all the pollutants, especially phosphorus and organics, as well as that sort of rapid pulse of water. So that ends up being very detrimental to the quality of lakes and rivers. Now, if you can get that water to infiltrate higher up in the landscape, and so seep down into the groundwater, you'll avoid having that rapid pulse of water. You'll also trap a certain amount of, or a large portion of, the pollutants that were associated with that storm event. And you'll basically allow water to move more slowly, and when it reaches the lake or the river, it will be much cleaner. And so that's really, you know, what we're shooting for here is, we know we can't go back to the pre-sort of urban, non-impervious, non-pavement landscape that we have. So can we put places in the landscape where we really focus that infiltration, focus that water improvement before it reaches lakes and streams? So for a while, what we were doing is putting in wetlands or using wetlands right before they got to the lake or the stream. So if there was a large wetland, you'd run the inlet into it and expect that wetland to sort of do all the cleaning. And people considered that kind of part of a wetland being a kidney in the landscape, so to speak. So what would happen, though, is if you had a nice wetland sort of performing that kind of kidney function, you would damage that natural wetland. So rather than doing that, if we can put these small infiltration opportunities sort of scattered around the landscape, and what we're doing is putting, or people are doing, is putting them in parking lots, putting them on the sides of roads, basically putting them in places right now that were oftentimes part of the problem. So part of the pollutant transport, now they're receiving that and then infiltrating the water, and then thereby sort of, I guess, keeping some of our natural wetlands from having to do that particular job.
Yes, excuse me. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You're basically talking about grass retention ponds or a building site, a planned development site. I see them all over the place.
Madam Chair, I think what there's a difference in the what's most common, which would be these retention ponds, mm-hmm. which are sort of deep water, and they tend to bounce a lot, and they do provide some of that function. What's interesting right now, and I think probably a step even in a better direction, is that there are more of these features that are shallower and actually have more vegetation in them. So they actually provide some sort of aesthetic amenity as well. They're less deep, they're less of a safety issue, as well as actually doing more infiltration in more places in the landscape. So this is an even more dispersed strategy. Maplewood has quite a few. Probably our nicest example, I believe, or our oldest example, is in the H.P. Fuller parking lots up in Badness Heights. And so at the scale of a parking lot, basically you can infiltrate and clean up the water on site before it leaves the site. And that's what's different than a lot of the ponds that you see. They're still collecting from many areas. And those have a valuable purpose, but I think actually having more and more parking lots actually cleaning up their own pollutants before they leave the site is what's so encouraging. And they can be really quite beautiful as well.
Representative Gunther.
Yeah. I look at that retention pond. Is there a way we could take what we typically call a retention plan to stop floodwaters? Can we plant appropriate vegetation in there so it does have a filtering mechanism towards it, and it can help our environment by planning it a little better?
Let's see. Madam Chair, yeah, the issue, I think, is that the design of those is that they're oftentimes very deep, and they receive a lot of water for a very small area. And so oftentimes they're designed to have a really high pulse, which makes putting interesting vegetation, interesting kinds of plants in them very problematic. And in fact, about the only kind of plant that can occur in many of those are invasive species, things that aren't too desirable. And so I think that while they have a benefit, there's some serious design limitations to them. We can't get rid of them entirely, but it's nice that we're sort of moving towards sort of a shallower version of this that actually probably we can do more things with.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Galatovich, I was wondering, I think you were, when you were talking about the rain gardens, and maybe that's in your next point, the rain gardens that are residential based, are you going to be talking about that?
I didn't talk about that.
With some of the housing, you know, individual residences as well as housing complexes.
Yes, the certainly most of these, I'd say, are going on, well, many of them are going on at a very small scale. So oftentimes, for instance, in Maplewood, they are going on at the sort of scale of the individual residence, also at the scale of the neighborhood. And so watershed districts are oftentimes doing the planning on these and the implementation. They oftentimes require certainly support and interest from individual owners because it will be affecting, you know, their property or at least their immediate vicinity of their property. So, but other than to say that this is a trend that's going on around the metro, I think it's a promising one.
Okay. Representative Hansen has another question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are rain gardens classified as wetlands?
No, I don't believe they would be classified as wetlands. Sorry.
I can try to...
Give your name for the record since you haven't been.
Sure. My name is Jeanette Brimmer. I'm the legal director at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And I think that rain gardens are not currently classified as wetlands. If what you're wondering is, would the Wetland Conservation Act apply to them, and all kinds of limitations, like the homeowner couldn't eliminate it if they so chose. I don't think that they are currently covered, but then, of course, neither do they get, for example, restoration credit or anything like that. I think that's the current status.
Thank you. Representative Poppy has a question on that.
Well, not a question, Madam Chair, but I don't remember which committee or when, but last year or the year before, we did hear that rain gardens like this are not considered wetlands, and I can't remember, but I thought H.B. Fuller and companies like that could get some kind of grants or money or, I don't know, money off their rainwater collection regurgitation tax or something. And,
I think that's
but they're not wetlands, so.
I think that's something we can check into, and we'll do that. If you'd continue.
And Madam Chair, that would make sense, too, because the substrate of these rainwater gardens is not at all like a natural wetland. They're more like a French drain with large rocks and boulders. They're still a very engineered sort of part of the landscape. So it would make sense from an ecological standpoint that they not be considered wetlands from a conservation point of view. The fifth positive trend that I see that's occurred in the past 10 years with regard to wetland restoration is the attempts that are being made to do really full landscape scale restoration. And the project that's really most notable here is the Nature Conservancy project up near Crookston Glacial Ridge, where they're attempting to restore really over 10,000, I think it's probably more like 20,000 acres of ephemeral, in other words, meadow and wet prairie wetland. That's a very interesting project. Certainly you can't do that everywhere in the state, or nor would it be desirable, but the fact that that sort of scale of restoration is being attempted, I think, is very notable and is nationally significant. They're also coupling this restoration with some research on how restoring wetlands at this sort of scale will affect groundwater supplies and groundwater flow movement. And so I think that's a very an interesting trend. More of those sort of large landscape scale restorations may also be logical, say, in the bottomland hardwood forests along the upper Mississippi River. And so that's another sort of example of sort of an ambitious scale that we weren't even thinking about 10 years ago. Now what I want to turn your attention to are what I see as some key issues and challenges that we face. You know, I think some things that maybe if I were here 10 years from now, I'd be happy to report that they aren't the way they are right now. And so let me walk you through those briefly. First of all, there's been certainly this increased interest and commitment to invasive species eradication. But I think what's important for managers to recognize right now, and everyone involved in restoration, is that eradication alone is not enough. That if you don't sort of somehow resolve or remove the kinds of causes that resulted in those invasions and those sort of spread of those invasive species, your site's going to be prone to having those problems again. And oftentimes we need to do follow-up restoration as part of that eradication. So if you wipe out a bunch of invasive species, lay the ground bare, it's out there, it's bare, what's going to move in quickest, the things that can get there fastest are invasive species. And so the problem we face here statewide is that what we know about eradication really works well at smaller scales, at the scale of, say, an acre or 10 acres or so forth. If you want to do really large wetland restorations, it can be very difficult to sort of do the eradication at that scale. On the other hand, right now we're limited by restoration to work at those large scales. And so going out and doing wholesale eradication of some of those invasive species with no further follow-up plan, I think could be counterproductive. It could end up wasting funds, and it could also cause sort of additional new problems. And there are some interesting things going on statewide. The helicopter picture is not a picture from Minnesota. I want to alert you to that. But I do want to alert you that there is some aerial spraying of invasive species in wetlands in the state for the purpose of restoration. There's at least several projects that I know of. It troubles me because I don't think they're necessarily coupled to restoration. And so if you go in and spray with a broad-spectrum herbicide, there's going to be non-target effects. And so I'm a little concerned right now that our enthusiasm for eradicating invasive species really needs to be tempered by an understanding of what it's going to take to keep that from simply coming back again.
Okay, excuse me for a minute. Representative McNamara has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Professor, I just want to ask your action. If we were to put, I'll refrain from using the word dump, if we were to put more money into, I shouldn't use that word because I believe we should be putting a lot more money into it. If we put more money into invasives, what kind of return do you think we would get? And I'm talking about the control. I kind of like to see the helicopter. I don't think we need enough helicopters, truthfully. I think we got a lot going on that we could be controlling and we have the ability to do it, but we don't always spend the money. And folks sometimes have the wrong reaction when they see that helicopter.
Let's see. Madam Chair, with respect to how to treat invasives, I think if we are going to do something aggressive, like landscape scale eradication, like you can do from the air, I think you probably need to make sure you have a sort of a good regional plan. So if you're going to try to, reduce reed canary grass from a region of the state, then I think you probably need to have a plan to make sure that you weren't just treating 150 acres and it was going to come right back again. So it's probably important that some of the funds go to having a strategic plan to actually figure out the feasibility of accomplishing that, so it's simply not spraying over and over. The other thing I think is critical to sort of couple some of the funds to is making sure that there aren't non-target effects. Making sure that that aerial spraying isn't going adjacent to a private property that if there's overdrift of glyphosate, that they wouldn't incur a major, you know, economic loss. So I think that's a problem.
Representative McNamara would like to follow up on that.
Just a quick follow-up, Professor. My point is, if we spent more money on it, would we get a good return, or do you think, in other words, if we spent a bunch more money to get rid of purple loosestrife throughout the seven-county metro area, do you think the positive return, whether it be economic or however we measured it, I'm just curious in your opinion. I think we brought you here to grill you a little bit, so I'm kind of working on your...
I think that's the right word.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't use words like that. But anyway, I'm just curious. I respect your opinion, and I'm thinking, I want to ask you, are we spending enough on it, and do you think if we spent more, we'd see a return?
Madam Chair, I don't think we're spending enough on it, but I think you'd almost need to go sort of species by species. And purple loosestrife, I believe, is a little bit different of a case than, say, reed canary grass. That one is an exotic. We did have a sort of, we were heading in the right direction with removal on that. I think they've, you know, hit some bumps in that, and we're seeing some sites come back again. So I would say that for something like purple loosestrife, the answer might be different than it might be for, say, another species like reed canary grass. So I think it sounds like a dodge, but it's what I'm thinking.
Are you thinking about biocontrols? I know we have started... We've been doing very small pieces of funding for biocontrols, and I think that is a subject that is going to be discussed a lot more this year. Is that something you were thinking about besides just spraying?
Madam Chair, yes. Definitely with Lithrum, there's, I think, some exciting biocontrol opportunities, and I don't work in that area, but you'll hear from others, I'm sure, that do have that expertise, but I know that some of that has gone quite well. With other species, biocontrol is probably not going to be a likely outcome or likely strategy in the future. The key point I want to make, though, is that I think we need to move beyond just eradication and also think about the transition to what we really want. And so, basically, if you do a lot of eradication, but we don't have enough native plants out there in the nursery industry to basically be able to put in those sort of opened up areas, then that's a problem. So I would try to couple the eradication with probably more attention to what happens afterwards. How do you kind of close that invasion window with some revegetation?
Representative Scalzi has a question on this area.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Ms. Gladwich. I have a question regarding some of the specific controls. For instance, I've heard of one called Sonar, which has been used to help eradicate Eurasian water milfoil, and maybe in larger bodies of water, maybe not so much wetlands. But I was wondering if you were familiar with that, and as I understand it, the state of Michigan is using this. I don't think it has yet been approved for use by our DNR, but it's just a target-specific eradication for just one type of species that would not kill the other vegetation that's there. But this one was specific for Eurasian water milfoil.
Madam Chair, I won't be able to speak specifically to sonar because I don't work in close enough to that area, but I know some of the folks in DNR will have that information. I think that in general, there it's always better to try to get a specific herbicide and avoid those broad spectrum herbicides. The question is, what are the other potential problems with it? For instance, you know, how flexible is it with respect to time of application? And so that can be an issue, even water temperature and so forth. But I'm going to have to probably pass on really giving you much information on sonar because I just don't know. Well, the second key challenge I believe that we face is coupled to the first one, and I've already sort of hinted at it, and that is that the commercial availability of native plants out there for people to rely on for restoration and the cost of those plants oftentimes limits restoration progress significantly. I talk to many private owners on the phone who call, who will say, I'd really like to restore my wetland, my riparian area, but I just found out it's going to cost me $10,000. And so the costs are significant. The more opportunities there are to share those costs, because there are public benefits, I think it makes sense. Also, though, it's important to realize that the amount, the availability of native plants is still, it's better than it was, but it's still too low to really drive many programs. And then what happens is if there's limited availability, people will go search for some things that are not quite right and are going to be prone to failure. In other words, things from other parts of the country or things that are cultivars that are actually more for cultural landscapes rather than conservation areas. So I think this is a key, interesting problem.
Yes, Representative Hansen has a follow-up on this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Gladowich, is the university doing any basic research on native plants? I mean, we have crop science department or horticulture department. Is there just basic, like, yield cultivar analysis, anything on plant breeding on these natives? And my part of my reason for asking that, we have a public purpose of the DNR growing trees for conservation, and we have the private market out here working on natives, but is there a public investment in research on native plants to get a better handle on what we have out there and how we could maybe reproduce them or provide them?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I'm actually in the horticulture department, so that's part of what my research program is. We're probably less interested from restoration in trying to develop cultivars than to do breeding, as much as to try to figure out how to make production systems more reliable. So, in other words, what size of plant do you need to grow in a greenhouse setting to be able to succeed when you put it out there in a lake in Minnesota, for example. We have that project going on right now. Which species can we seed restorations and have that be a better strategy than using plugs? In other words, if we can demonstrate that the money is worth it from the standpoint that you'll succeed more often than if you just let things go, I think that's part of the key. Part of it, though, so part of it's research, and we're, you know, doing the best we can with limited funds to try to help out where we can. And we have good linkages with many of the native plant producers. I think the other question, though, is the market, and most of this is state funded, and so the market, you know, the amount of sales that a business can get is going to be tied very directly to what kinds of government programs are sort of creating that demand. And in some cases, some of our state agencies have coupled with, say, Ramsey County Corrections. And so the corrections folks now are producing most of what are the emergent plants for Minnesota restoration. So that's not private at all. Okay, the third challenge that I see is that when you do have failures that are predictable, excuse me, in restoration, because somebody decided to cut a corner and try to say, to do a practice in a way that we know does not work, there's still a lot of ability to get away with that and to continue on. And what I'm getting at here is the issue of low bids. So when an agency needs to go to low bid to do work, and one bid comes in because at a much higher rate, because they say it takes 2 years to fill this invasive species, and the other one comes in and says, we can do it in 1 year. The 1 year is going to get the project, even though we have good data to suggest, not to suggest, we know that a year is not going to be enough. And so when that sort of attempt fails, there's really little that can happen at that point. The project simply is a failure. And so what I see is a extreme unevenness out there in the private sector with regard to the companies that are actually doing the work, that some are able to do a lot of projects using practices that we know are not really going to be very likely to succeed. And so I think that's troubling in a way, that we do have some firms out there, some contractors, who will do the right thing, but they're going to less often get the job than somebody who's willing to cut corners. And so if you do that in the world of bridge building, you know, obviously you're going to have a huge sort of public outcome. But in the world of restoration, the liability for failure is a lot lower. And so I think that's an interesting problem.
We have two questions here. First from Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Professor, I'm going to beg to differ in a pretty serious way. If we want to use the bridge example was not Lunda's fault. It was the engineer's fault for not properly designing. And I'll take what you said about the bridge. The bridge on 494 was not the contractor's fault. It was the designer's fault because they didn't figure out the span was bigger than it really should have been. If you laid out specs for somebody that was going to take 2 years and told them they could do it in 1 year, and I don't mean to say you, whoever's doing the design, having worked in that profession for 30 years, being a bid contractor, you can have the most successful work if it's designed properly. If it takes 2 years to kill reed canary grass, write that in the specifications that the contractor needs to take 2 years. But low bid contracting is one of the best things this country has. Absolutely. I would not want to see it degraded here. I just want to beg to differ strongly. Having worked in that profession and done a very good job at it, that's a terrific system that we have that works very well, and I would not put the blame on the contractors. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I'm going to agree with you. I think you hit the nail on the head there, that it's not the low bid per se, but our inability to work for many restoration managers and regulators to actually work in that system. And so I agree. I really think that you characterized it well. And so the issue is making sure the bid specifications are correct and then trying to bring up the standards and trying to make them uniform. And so I think that's really true.
We have another question, but I think you've identified a problem that we need to work on, because otherwise we're just sinking money into something that's not going to work. So that's something we ought to be paying attention to. There was a question over here. Representative Nathan.
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And, Doctor, I guess my question was partially answered already, but I was wondering what kind of consequences there would be for a contractor. It sounds like the contractor is involved in actually designing as well. That's part of the problem, the way it sounds, is that the state should actually be taking a more active role in setting up the specifications rather than leaving it to the contractors, who may not have the expertise in that area. But I was wondering if there is a failure, is there any kind of consequence for the contractor that completed the project?
Madam Chair, I'm afraid I'm not going to have a sort of good sense of how that works, other than I see failures on the landscape, and we know they're the result of projects being handled in a way we could have predicted that would have not succeeded. So I think there's certainly a role for it. I think part of the issue is that there's so many people out there working in this arena. It's not simply sort of here in St. Paul, but it's dispersed across the state in terms of the authority to sort of enter into these kinds of arrangements, that I think it's probably, you know, a whole lot of education that needs to happen. But I won't be able to speak specifically about kind of how the contractors in each situation would have to come back in or not. I suspect that it would depend on the agency that they're working with. Sorry for the dodge.
Go ahead.
Okay. And I have two more, and I'll try to move through these. The fourth issue and challenge I believe we face is that restoration monitoring, you know, really hasn't gotten off the ground yet. There's certainly been attempts to monitor restorations. We, for instance, have efforts that we'll certainly now be able to say if a restoration project is still there or not, or in some simple way has sort of met some of the basics of a plan that was generated. But a monitoring system that really tells us whether or not we have long-term success with these efforts, whether they're truly replacements for natural wetlands in the landscape, simply is you know, still very elusive. I think that we have some benefits in the state that we could rely on here. We have an incredible network of state natural areas. We also have a good dispersion of four-year universities and colleges. And so we basically have an opportunity to perhaps have some distributed monitoring of natural sites to be able to compare and benchmark these restorations to. I think the approach of sending out a couple of interns does not work. This is a really tough thing to do. Nationally, it's been problematic for many states and federal agencies. And so our approach to sort of throw a couple of sort of freshly minted bachelor's folks out there is simply not enough. The fifth issue and challenge that I see is that I think we're now getting to the point with the research that we've been doing that I think we understand that basically some wetlands may be what I would consider, some wetlands may be what we would consider anthropogenic relics, you know, and I think we all sort of have heard about glacial relics, you know, little tiny places in the landscape that are there left over from a previous climatic era, and if they're gone, they can't be replaced again. And I'm beginning to believe that at least some of our kinds of wetlands may actually be relics of another kind of period of land use. And I would say that probably some of our sedge meadows might be examples of this, especially those in southern Minnesota that are on relatively fertile soils. There's been some interesting work out of Laval University showing that the increase in reed canary grass is very much associated with increased use of synthetic fertilizers across that province as well as soil disturbance. And we have a good understanding of the role of nitrogen and reed canary grass in sedge meadow communities. And it's nearly impossible to eradicate, remove reed canary grass and get the natives to win without, you know, really excessive amounts of financial inputs and time. So are we at the point with some kinds of wetlands where we begin to believe that the cost of restoration is prohibitive under almost any reasonable scenario? And does that make the case for being perhaps more interested in protection of those particular kinds of wetlands when we get to the point where we believe that what it would take to do those restorations would be, you know, often or more often than not unfeasible? And so I think that's a worthwhile sort of thing to be wondering about. We believe that certainly for wetlands like calcareous fens, and also right now I would say for bogs. And it may be interesting over time to try to figure out how to gauge which kinds of wetlands are really restorable and which ones are simply not. And that's what I have today. Thank you.
Well, I think we have some more questions.
Okay.
Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is more of I have two questions, not necessarily related, but possibly. When you're talking about a lot of these things, I keep hearing eradication and dealing with invasives, and I have a background in conservation, and it's obviously cheaper to prevent things, and I'm wondering what your view of how much we're focusing on prevention versus only eradication, and if balancing that or changing that balance a little bit would be more cost effective and better for managing our wetlands.
Madam Chair, I would agree that we need to put a whole lot more attention on conservation, prevention of invasive species coming in to begin with. Also, eradication, or not eradication, but at least control of species before they get completely out of hand. So more early detection of some of these problems. And then also I want to couple to that probably more interest in wetland protection, again, for our highest quality wetlands, and not assuming that so many things are going to be restorable. and I think that that's becoming increasingly clear. I work in wetland restoration. I certainly enjoy trying to do this. We've been successful sometimes, but are we replacing natural wetlands easily and in a financially reasonable way? I don't think we can say that yet. I can tell you that many people in state agencies are doing a good job, trying very hard, and probably are doing a better job than maybe state agencies most anywhere else in the U.S., but it's still very problematic.
And Madam Chair, the other question I have is wetland restoration in terms of a changing climate, and if there is any indication that the way we're managing wetlands or dealing with invasives as not just what's on the land is changing, but the conditions that create what's on the land is changing, and how that goes into controlling invasives and preventing invasives and just managing for climate as well, as any indication of how that's working.
Madam Chair, I think that the biggest issue with regard to climate change is going to be making sure that the landscape has sort of enough connections or connectivity, enough places that are still sort of in a natural state to allow the native species to be able to move and colonize. The thing we have out there are invasive species that are widespread, and they're going to be able to sort of handle climate change because of their widespread distribution. With regard to a lot of our natural areas, since in many parts of the state they're very patchy, what you're going to have is an increasingly problematic situation where when you restore sites, the species are not going to be able to sort of reassemble on the newly restored landscape areas. And so the dispersal of plants and animals into newly restored areas from our remnant natural areas is one of the key problems I see with trying to sort of keep up with what we're understanding about global climate. It's really the sort of distribution of native species, and that'll be key, I believe.
Thank you. Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am interested in compost for a variety of reasons, from a background in the solid waste field, but I know that compost has been used in erosion control and some wetland management projects, and I'm just wondering what the prospects are for using that for things like rainwater gardens and other restoration projects.
Madam Chair, using compost in many wetland restorations will be actually counterproductive, because what we have is too much fertility, probably relative to what was there historically. So actually the amendment we're looking for and trying to work with is sawdust. We're trying to drive down the nitrogen that's been added to the soil. And that's not going necessarily really well right now, but we're actually trying to drop the nitrogen down in glacial restorations that are going on in the southern part of the state. Compost might have its place certainly in some of those rainwater gardens as a top dressing, especially on some of the sandier soils. But probably compost is an important part of wetland restoration. It probably has its role. It might be limited to special situations because we need to keep the fertility down oftentimes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Deacon.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Doctor. I was wondering about the land acquisition part of this. How is land acquired for such projects? You're talking about the project up in Crookston, for instance, Glacial Ridge, which is 20,000 acres, I believe you said. I was wondering how that land was acquired and how land for other projects are acquired.
The land for that Glacial Ridge project was purchased by the Nature Conservancy from a private owner, or a group of private owners, and my understanding is that will now become part of a national wildlife refuge. And so the Nature Conservancy was pivotal in making that sort of land acquisition happen. Certainly, many of the projects that are going on in the state are going to be purchased through banks and other, it's going to vary quite a bit, but I believe the one at William O'Brien was a private piece of property and was sold to the state for restoration. It's part of a public restoration bank. So I think restoration banks are NHP, as well as an increasing sort of interest in groups like the Nature Conservancy to be involved in restoration.
I think we'll take one more question. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Director. My question is about carbon sequestration and looking at that carbon-nitrogen ratio that you talked about in wetlands. On an acre-per-acre basis, are we able to store, can you just compare carbon sequestration in wetlands versus terrestrial? How do we, is it better, can we store more in a wetland than we can in an open field with native bird?
Madam Chairman, well, that sounds like a prelim question at the university. I'm not gonna do a good job at this. I'm gonna give you, I guess, a guess here, and my guess is that the carbon sequestration is probably going to be mostly a function of the biomass of the plants. And so if you have a wetland that has lots of plant biomass, it's going to be as good as a terrestrial system. You also will have a certain amount of storage of carbon in wetland soils that you don't necessarily have in upland soil, but that is counterbalanced by methane discharge. And so that's what I'm hedging on here, is that they do discharge methane, and that is a greenhouse gas too. So I'm a little fuzzy on how that balance would come out, except to say wherever you have a lot of plant biomass, you're going to be doing carbon sequestration. And so probably doing it both in upland and in wetland habitats is probably a good thing that you can count on.
Thank you for this. This has been helpful, certainly to me, and I hope to the rest of the committee.
Great, thank you.
We're going to next go to Jeanette Brimmer, who's the legal director of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And they have issued reports on wetlands, and it's because of that that we invited them, her to come to the committee to talk about the numbers, the quantity, and the quality.
Yeah, let's hope the technology works.
I think I have to power down and
start over.
Yep.
We thought we were all done with and had it all ready to transfer over.
Oh, members, while you're waiting, there is more coffee up there.
Physical violence.
I didn't have a whole understanding.
Did it try to stay out of the way? Did it try to stay out of the way?
Representative Hansen has made a good suggestion that we approve the minutes while we're waiting, because we're almost ready here, I think. And would you do that, Representative Hansen?
So moved.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. Okay, how are we coming here? Welcome, Representative Carlson. There's coffee up there. If you would like, we're waiting for a PowerPoint to come up, and we think it's about ready. Begin. Very good.
Thank you for indulging me. Okay. My name is Jeanette Brimmer. I'm the legal director at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. And we are a nonprofit environmental organization here in Minnesota. And we work in a number of areas. I'm sure I've visited with a number of you in the past on our pesticide program. We have a water quality and energy program. And wetlands is one of the areas that we have been working in for many years on a variety of fronts. What brings me here today is basically wetlands and our wetlands report. Let me give you just a little bit of background on how we got started on that. We had been working in the wetland area for quite some time at the time of the first, as we affectionately refer to it, the duck rally a couple of years ago. And we had a table at the duck rally. We were working with a number of those conservation groups on the steering committee. And we wanted to sort of advance our advocacy through that. We knew we were going to be talking to a lot of people who are regularly out in the landscape, understand, know what's going on with wetlands. They've got a history. They've maybe been going back to the same place as their favorite duck hunting place for years and years. And so we collected stories. We said, tell us your wetland story. Is there a wetland that you have seen change in character, that you have seen eliminate? Is there one that you think is an improvement on the landscape, so that we could start to get a feel for that? We then used a recent master's degree graduate from the university that summer to follow up on those stories, to do Freedom of Information Act requests, to gather information, to talk to locals. And those stories really formed the foundation of our first wetland report that we published last February, February of 06. And I have started writing the second one, but I am behind, so I can't promise you anything by the middle of February, but I am shooting for the first week of March, which will sort of expand on and talk about some additional issues to the first one. So I'm going to address to you the first one today. So let's go into a little bit of background.
These the next couple of maps, by the way, are used with the permission of the Board of Water and Soil Resources. You can see these on their website as well. I also want to invite you to visit our website that you've got information on, where you can download the entirety of this report. These are wetlands primarily prior to European settlements. This is what Minnesota's landscape looked like. If you had a better resolution of this, you'd actually see distinctions in the coloration relating to wetland type. Sorry about that. This is wetlands of today, and by today, I use that term loosely. This is 1984. That's the best information we have right now in terms of comprehensive statewide information. And indulge me while I toggle back and forth, because I think that that gives you a little bit of a flavor of how much we have lost. And you can see that it is in particular parts of the state. Here's another way of looking at it, also Board of Water and Soil Resources. And you can see that the agricultural regions of the state are those regions that have the fewest remaining wetlands. I've seen some data, if you go county by county, some of those counties literally are reporting zero pre-settlement wetlands remaining in that county. What I want to draw your attention to, we will talk some about agricultural issues here today, but I also want to draw the committee's attention to development. While agricultural impacts may have historically been the single largest impact to wetlands, suburban, urban, and even regional small city development is fast catching up to and equaling the wetland loss or wetland impacts that we are experiencing. So on this map, that sort of light green area, in 1984, many of those counties may very well, given the way that wetland impacts are going, have moved further down the list and may be entering the light pink area. We just don't have comprehensive data on how or to what extent that's going. I'm going to talk to you today about the confines of the regulatory program, and that's very important. By that I mean primarily our own state law, the Wetland Conservation Act, which was passed in 1991. There have been adjustments to it since then, but that's really when it went on the books. That and federal law is the Clean Water Act, subscribe to a concept called no net loss. And if you've dealt with wetlands at all, you will have heard of this, no net loss. This came from the first Bush administration in the late 80s, who said, you know what, we do have to do something about wetlands, and I want to at least stem the tide of lost wetlands. I want to make sure that for every wetland acre that is impacted, we do something good or kind to wetlands in return, so that we have a no net loss on the landscape under the regulatory program. And this state largely adopted that same no net loss concept within the Wetland Conservation Act. That is where that term no net loss is properly used, within those four corners of the law and regulation. Now you may hear, and that's what we're going to talk about here today, is the law and the regulation, the operation of what you passed in 1991, serving its purpose of no net loss of wetlands. You may hear a lot of talk about, well, there's net gain. You know, there's this restoration, there's that restoration, and Dr. Galata, which I think did a good job of saying, we are improving. We are doing a better and better job all the time. We may be a state leader on restoration. But a lot of that restoration is dependent on the good graces of voluntary participants. A lot of it is dependent on funding from federal, farm, and other programs. And it could disappear, it's uneven, and that's why we do not include that in our analysis. Because when you passed the Wetland Conservation Act, that was the consideration. Anything else is kind of apples to oranges, and I wanted to make sure that that was clear. Federal studies and reports saying, basically, we have slowed wetland loss. We're doing better, it's not occurring at anywhere near the rate that it had been occurring for many years. But we have not stopped it. In other words, we have not yet achieved, under our regulations, no net loss. U.S. Fish and Wildlife has a report that affects the National Academies of Science, was very critical at the federal level of how we are handling this. And that last report was actually requested by Representative Oversar. And this report is just a year old. The General Accountability Office reported, similar to what the National Academies had previously reported, that no net loss under the federal regulatory system, largely administered by the Army Corps of Engineers, is not working. We are not achieving no net loss. While our state reports are not quite as thorough, we do have reports from the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Those two report, at least within the confines of the regulatory system, a net loss of wetland acres. And in the most recent report, I think that 2001 to 2003 time frame, that report came out a little over a year ago, they reported, I want to say, I think I had this branded into my head, 1,367 acres lost during that period of time, which may not seem like a lot spread across the landscape, but the Bowser report will also tell you that's what we know. And one of the things that we will talk to you about, that we talk about in our report, is we don't really know. We don't keep track of exemptions. We don't have good statewide data. And so at least for what they were able to track, they said it's 1,367 acres. It is probably higher. In preparing our report based on the case studies we have, we identified three problem areas that may be contributing to the continued net loss of wetlands under our state law. This is by no means completely comprehensive. We didn't have the funds or the time to do that. That's why we're doing a separate report that we hope will supplement some of the information. But there were three general areas that immediately came to light. There are exemptions written into the Wetland Conservation Act. That's because it was a difficult compromise. There were a lot of people at the table. It was the first time the state had done it. The legislature was doing the best with the information it had, and so it wrote the Wetland Conservation Act with some exemptions, where certain activities in wetlands were not required to be replaced or restored or mitigated. And those do appear to be contributing to the continued loss. And that's maybe a point for me to make as well. The case studies that we reported on were not necessarily bad activity or bad behavior or failures by someone in government. It was an attempt to actually give an accurate picture of how does the law work, good, bad, or indifferent. In other words, some of these things are perfectly legal and allowable, but it does still result in net loss. We also, and I'll go into some detail on these as we move through, using some of the case studies to illustrate. Inadequate enforcement. Again, this is not an attempt to say bad government regulators. This is more an attempt to say government regulators that are scrambling on the landscape to keep up with the demand. DNR has 5 wetland conservation officers to cover the entire state. Needless to say, that's too few, and they are struggling with that. Bowser's trying very hard to work on restoration, to get people in local government trained, but sometimes you've got maybe one person at the county level that's supposed to handle not maybe just wetland stuff, but all environmental issues that county is trying to deal with. And that's just a big strain on the folks that are trying to enforce these laws and see that they are carried out. And finally, we identified what I'm going to call a confusion between wetland and drainage laws. There's an entire chapter of the statutes devoted to public drainage, very important to agriculture in this state over the years and into the future. But the two of them impact each other, but we haven't done a very good job of really matching them up for administrators and folks that are trying to comply with both laws. And we've identified that as contributing to some of the problems with the Wetland Act. I'm going to start with some examples here that typify a number of the things that are going on. We have identified agricultural exemptions as possibly contributing mostly to the loss of diversity, which I think Dr. Gladowich addressed. It's not just about, there are lots of different types of wetlands. And we have largely exempted types 1 and 2 from the reach of the Wetland Conservation Act. You see an example of that kind of wetland here, which a lot of people would say, that's a wetland that looks like a low spot in the field that gathered water when it rained the last time. Yeah, but that's a wetland. And there's very technical ways to determine that. You can historically even determine that through a sample or a survey and analysis of the soil. There are certain types of soils that are wetland soils. You can tell if there is any remnant vegetation, that can be a clue. So that's how you determine a wetland. We also identified enforcement issues, some of which are in fact at the federal level. I note that this committee will be hearing from the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and I would encourage you to ask some tough questions about them and what they are doing to enforce their version of the wetland laws. This is another picture. This is drain pile. If you're from rural Minnesota, I'm insulting your intelligence by telling you that. But there are some folks that may not know that. This is partly what allows us to be so productive agriculturally. This drain pile gets put in and helps dry the land out, dry it more quickly, dry places that were maybe too wet to be productive year after year. We use this extensively. We are like one big plumbing system here in Minnesota. We could probably traverse the world several times with the drain pile that we have laid. While it is important to our economy, it also does have an impact on wetlands. And we identified some case studies where sometimes it's improper behavior. There was a case in McLeod County where some contractor came forward and kind of ratted out the head contractor and the landowner and said, we were replacing drain tile, and the wetland law says you can replace it if it was already there, you're grandfathered in, but you're supposed to put it in sort of the same level, same size, to get the same drainage, and you don't increase potential impacts. And they said, well, it was very deeper, and we had a piece of dummy tile in when the guy came out to look at it. And what happened is the federal government decided not to enforce that and not to dig it up and look at it. And then the state government felt that their hands were tied. They felt that even though we have independent authority under our own Wetland Act, they could not go double-check that and sort of override what the federal government had done. And so one of the points we make in the Wetland Report is maybe we need to have stronger independent authority. We have our own law. We should be able to enforce our own law. Approved development and de minimis exemptions. Approved development was is sort of a relic. In 1991, when the Wetland Conservation Act was passed, there were obviously a lot of people with a lot of plans that were ready to go forward that may be impacted if the act applied to them immediately. And so the legislature said, okay, if you have met certain requirements, you've already got permits in hand, you're ready to break ground, basically. It's not fair for us to impact you with this new law. We understand that. So if you have met these requirements, you can go ahead. You're exempted from the reach of the Wetland Conservation Act. That was over 15 years ago. And in our case studies, we've discovered that mostly this isn't used that much, but where it was used, there was some abuse, there was some confusion, and perhaps it's time at this point, if you haven't built your project, and it's probably unlikely that you've actually kept the permits and everything current, that we can let this go as something that probably wouldn't affect a lot of people but would certainly help tighten up the act. De minimis exemption is very interesting, and I'm going to give you the Baxter Walmart as a case study that we looked at and reported on in the report. De minimis is also one of those compromises, and it basically says if you're only going to shave a little bit off the wetland, we'll give you a pass on that. And it's different depending on what part of the state you're in. If you're in one of those areas that you saw on that colored map that's very red, your de minimis is much smaller because we just don't have that much to lose. Whereas in the northern parts of the state that have 80, 90% of their wetlands remaining, your de minimis exemption is much larger. They figured that they could afford to lose that. Again, you can see that compromise in action. What we're struggling with, I think, and what the case study indicates is that there are sometimes what we saw in that case is subdividing in other ways that this exemption gets misused. And also you have to ask yourself, how many de minimis exemptions before I'm really having an impact on the landscape? And in fact, in the stakeholder process that Bowser had over the course of this summer and fall and at the roundtable, Bowser did report that they think de minimis is one of the primary exemptions that are contributing to continued net loss. Again, we may not be, we're not talking tens of thousands of acres across the landscape, but it has been identified as one of the pieces of the law that perhaps is contributing to that. Let's talk about the case study. In this Baxter case, there was a parcel of property. They were going to claim a certain amount of de minimis wetland impact. There were a lot of wetlands scattered across this property, but they really wanted to impact more than just that little piece. The plan was pulled off the table, came back later, and it was subdivided. And now they're going to claim de minimis on both pieces. Now, technically, the rules say you're not allowed to do that, but the local government unit went ahead and said you can have de minimis on both. Walmart was one of the developer then that bought one piece of the property. And what I've got here, and so they use their full de minimis on that piece. Well, you know, how many times is that going to happen? Maybe we need some more controls on that. This is some of what's left after we see development. I think, as I said, no self-respecting duck is going to show up here en route to the Tundra. In fact, I did this for some guys at Ducks Unlimited, and I have to share one of the comments that he made because I love it. On the bottom picture, he said, wow, they even made a nice ramp to get your boat in there. I think he appreciated what he was looking at there and how absurd it was that this is a saved wetland and that this is really doing much for habitat diversity. And again, I want to point out Dr. Gladowitz's comments that we may be saving this wet spot on the landscape, but are we really doing anything for habitat, for the environment? She talked about connectedness on the landscape as an important component. This is not connectedness, needless to say. Those are some examples of the exemptions. Again, we will be talking about more of those and following up with additional case studies in our new report, and I invite you to read the detailed case studies in the 2006 report that is on our website. Couple of enforcement issues. Minnesota Statute Section 1599 is causing a lot of pain and anguish on the landscape and is allowing, one of our case studies was about someone being able to end up possibly getting an exemption that they might not otherwise have been entitled to because of the workings of this statutory section. They kind of got caught in that deadline. And there is just a ton of litigation going on in this. One of the new case studies that I'm looking at is from Tenaga County, and it's going all the way up to the Court of Appeals on this 1599, and it has to do with whether this person will get an exemption. They were, in fact, ordered to restore the wetland because they were in violation of the Wetland Conservation Act. It's just causing a lot of complications and difficulties, and is possibly allowing some net loss on the landscape because of its operation. Enforcement resources are lacking. I'm by no means an expert on this, but I have heard this kicked around. DNR could use 3 to 5 more wetland enforcement officers just within their agency alone. I think that the local governments need more resources to do this. They are strapped for a lot of reasons. You probably hear that in every committee hearing you're in. But it's true. It is really true that environmental issues generally and certainly on wetlands, they are handling a big caseload. It requires a lot of expertise, and those resources are sorely needed to deliver on the promise of the Wetland Conservation Act. Drainage, we also identified as an issue. You see here a picture of a recently cleaned out drainage ditch. This is kind of in West Central Minnesota. I'm trying to remember what county. I want to say maybe Becker or Otterdale. I'm not sure, though. The Wetland Act gives exemptions for existing drainage and maintenance of existing drainage. And as I indicated, you're not allowed to increase your benefits, but you are allowed to maintain what you've got, to do ditch cleanouts, to remove obstructions, to replace tile that is broken or worn out. But what we are finding is it's in those real old repair situations that there starts to be confusion and crossover between the drainage law and the wetlands law, and not everything is protected as it should be. That wetlands exemption applies only if you've been diligent in maintaining your drainage system and wetlands have not reestablished themselves. If they reestablish themselves and they've been on the landscape for 25 years, you have to figure that system's been out of repair for a while if they're back on the landscape for 25 years. Then you are recaptured and brought back into the Wetland Conservation Act. The problem that we noted in some case studies, there was one from Douglas County that the Fish and Wildlife Service was involved in that actually impacted one of their wildlife protection areas, is that we aren't doing the best job in making sure that when we are cleaning out or repairing drainage systems, that we are referring back to the Wetland Conservation Act and that those two laws are meeting up, and that we are paying attention to the requirements and the benefits of both of them. This is another drainage example. This one was in the papers. This one, for now, has been fixed, although I'm not sure the controversy has gone away. This is Rice Lake. It's part of the Paul Hugo Farms Wildlife Management Area, which is entirely owned by DNR in Washington County. This is what it looks like, what I want to call normally, or did look like. This picture was taken by us at one of the public access points, popular hunting spot, in the spring of 03 or 04, if I'm recalling correctly. This is what it looked like at almost exactly the same time of year in 05. This is the result of a ditch clean out by the watershed district that resulted in drainage of the lake because they came too close to the lake. Now, that has been restored. The watershed district said, oops, didn't mean to do that. Put a berm back in. The lake water level has been restored, and it's interesting to hear Dr. Gladowich talk about invasives because one of the results of that lake bottom being exposed over the course of a summer and some of the fall is that hybrid cattails, which are invasive, took that over, and this summer it had no open water. It was full of those invasive cattails, and DNR had to engage in an eradication program. And when I say the controversy is not over, I'll tell you that the city of Hugo actually petitioned to clean out the ditch again this summer, but that has luckily been withdrawn after some work with the PCA.
We have two questions. Representative Ansley.
Madam Chair, Ms. Grimmer, I really appreciate your presentation here today. What jumps out at me, however, is the word enforcement. And I get the feel we have a patchwork quilt, and I get the feel that there's confusion between the state agency and 87 county boards of commissioners and duality of responsibilities and confusion of roles. And how would you describe the partnership between the state agency and the local units of government? And how would you describe any, in your view, any statutory clearing up that could be done to make this responsibility more understandable to the community at large?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's complicated to have a one-size-fits-all answer to that. We've been very heavily involved in stakeholder groups over the course of the summer. Local government has been at those groups. I think it can vary county by county significantly and watershed by watershed. It also, interestingly, varies between individuals within those local units of government. In other words, the person that is part of a technical panel or the person that is the environmental staff member may actually be out there on the landscape, understanding, enforcing, doing a very good job, but the county commissioners have a different balance that they engage in that may be more, for example, pro-development. So you get, I think patchwork is the good word to use, really, in a lot of ways. I see a lot of local government individuals who really care about this, who are doing a good job, that want to do a good job. You can tie a lot of it to resources. I mean, bottom line is, you know, does the county have enough money to hire the right people with the right expertise to get out there in the landscape, especially counties that have a lot of wetlands? Counties that are experiencing a lot of shoreland development right now are counties that are going to be particularly strapped. So I think that that answer may differ, but I think bottom line is we could do a better job. We could do a better job with just more bodies and more education in a lot of ways.
Okay. Representative Gardner has, we're getting close to our time. Representative Gardner has the top hat.
Quick question, Madam Chair. Because you said that was Rice Lake. That's Rice Creek in Hugo, if I'm not mistaken. Or is it Rice Lake?
Madam Chair, Representative Gardner, it's Rice Creek Watershed District. This is Rice Lake, and in fact, the ditch is also known as Hardwood Creek. There are a lot of terms to keep straight, so that's what we are looking at in that picture. Thank you. As I said, this is an example of some of the confusion. That they thought that they were just doing some minor maintenance. Wasn't so minor. Let's look at this one. This is Pine County. This is a drainage ditch. This looks beautiful and bucolic, and it's grass and there's lovely water, except before the ditch cleanout, which in fact the county enforced and said was improper and the person didn't follow the law, you could walk across this. So needless to say, it's not in its natural state, pretty as the picture might be. This is upstream. This is the lake that was impacted when that ditch was dug out. The person that owned this property was able to park their pontoon boat there previously at that dock. And needless to say, that's no longer the case. I can also report that the lake level here has come up some. It does not look this bad anymore. But it's not returned to where it was pre-cleanout. This is just another example of how those drainage activities can impact water on the landscape. So what are some of the possible solutions that we throw out in that report? There are some monitoring and reporting solutions that would really help us better understand, help us, I'm talking particularly about our regulators, what's going on out there. Track and report exemptions, that's been discussed a lot. We are talking about a minimal activity because here I am making speeches about burdens on local government. I don't want to impose a lot more burdens. This could be reporting to local government. It could be reporting to Bowser, and I'm talking about a check-off box. You know, Joe Smith at this location hereby declares I'm taking a de minimis exemption. It would really help us start to understand. Bowser made some efforts to informally collect that data, but it's no means scientifically reliable at this point. Provide funding for comprehensive monitoring and assessment of wetland gains and losses. We're lucky that a lot of this can be done with aerial photographs and GIS mapping, but it takes time, it takes resources to do that. Our annual or biennial reporting on wetland protection to the governor with recommendations from experts. We had this going on for a while. That's where we got those Bowser reports. But lack of resources has caused that to go away, and I think that was an important function. It's the only way we can really keep track of whether we're delivering on that no net loss promise. Let's talk about some of the exemptions. Independent state authority to assess entitlement to agricultural exemptions. I think that we don't have to do what the feds do. They have a different law. Maybe it turns out that it's the same. But we have our own law, we have our own purposes to that law, and our people should feel that they have the authority to administer and enforce our law. Use the inventory that's being done right now. Fish and Wildlife, DNR, there are a number of groups that are working together on an inventory to require restoration of types 1 and 2 and limit 1 and 2 exemptions. We use a regulatory system of 8 different wetland types. Types 1 and 2 are they're the sedge meadows, they're the smaller areas, they are not wet or contain open water year-round. We have hugely sacrificed those wetlands so that there are very few of them left on the landscape. And referring back to Dr. Galatowicz's talk, it's important that we have that diversity of wetland types. These smaller, more shallow ones that dry up later actually have proven to be important duck habitat. Ducks Unlimited have demonstrated that they melt out sooner in the spring and they become productive, meaning that they're producing all of the little things that ducks like to eat on their way north before the big lakes or the larger open water wetlands are fully melted up and adequately warmed up to be as productive. So these are a really important component on the landscape, and we've really lost a lot of them. Eliminate the approved development exemption as no longer needed and somewhat subject to abuse, and revise the de minimis exemption around an ecological basis. In our report, we suggest, one, that we should probably reduce the de minimis exemption, but more importantly, let's cap it so that we aren't nibbled to death. Let's figure out a way to apportion it on the landscape, possibly on a county-by-county basis, so that we don't continue to nibble away, particularly in those counties that are already severely strapped for wetlands. We have some suggestions with respect to drainage repair. If we did formal petitions, We would have a more public and open process, and maybe we should capture, or we would capture, some of these older maintenance or repairs that need to pay attention to whether the wetlands have existed for 25 years. I think a more formal process, better definitions of what is repair versus minor maintenance, things like that, I think would help clarify really for all of the users. We're not talking about taking this away. We are not talking about eliminating its use on the landscape. It serves an important function, but just let's make sure everybody's on the same page. There are some ditches like that one in Pine County where actually it appears the majority of residents may be interested in abandoning them. And Pine County has abandoned a couple of ditches recently, but the procedure is rather difficult, rather complicated, and one person can prevent abandonment. And so there are things that we suggest that we could look at, that if the ditch truly is not needed anymore and is not benefiting anyone, that perhaps we should streamline procedures. I'm going to speed through some of these. You've heard a lot today. We talked a lot already about resources for enforcement. We have a suggestion for what we call the wetland SWAT team, which would really largely involve DNR wetland officers that maybe have a special task in reporting to the governor. I invite you to look at those. Give us a call. I'm more than happy to talk about it and look for the publication of the next installment, hopefully in March.
Thank you very much. We are a little past our time, and I appreciate your being here, and I think if folks have questions for her afterwards, she would take them. Thanks again.
Thank you for the invitation.
With that, please.